This is Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 10th of March, and while we all tried to hunker down and avoid the bad weather, Radio 1 gave us tall tales.
You know, when police were looking, they were talking about sinkholes. It's an area where there are sinkholes and caves, whether he could have fallen into one or whether his body has been hidden in one. There are death adders in that area. There are occasionally crocodiles. That's not entirely true. There's a pet crocodile at the pub.
High drama.
But every time I've gone on Good Morning Britain, I thought, my goodness, thank goodness that I'm not actually at loggerheads with him, because I wouldn't have been as brave as Alex was to challenge him. It's quite a terrifying prospect.
And advice to help lower your blood pressure.
And reality has shifted, so we have to shift our expectations. And if you didn't get enough homeschooling today and your children are still safe and they're still loved, that's enough. If they have too much screen time today, still safe, still loved, it's fine.
I'm Gemma Craddock, and there's plenty to get through, so let's get going. The unwelcome precursor to April showers, March deluges, have us all tied closer to home than usual. It's no better time to pick up a new page turner. Enter Ashley O'Drain with her best-selling debut novel, The Push. She gave Ryan the elevator pitch.
So The Push is it's about a woman named Blythe who comes from a history of women that have struggled greatly with motherhood, you know, her own mum and her grandmother in particular. And she's determined that she's going to break the cycle, you know, that she's going to be the very warm, present, engaged mother that she hoped she would always have. And so she and her husband welcome a baby named Violet, but it's not long until she starts to believe there is something wrong with Violet. There is something very different about her. She's very angry and very aloof and soon begins to act maliciously towards other children at preschool. And the problem, of course, is that Blythe's husband, you know, cannot see in their daughter Violet what she sees. You know, he thinks it's very much a result of the maternal anxiety that she's carried for so long and really the stress of motherhood. And so the family unravels from there, and that sort of kicks off the story.
Perfectly described, as I'd hope. And now we're into a smorgasbord of places to go in terms of what this book is about. I noticed that you describe it beautifully as an emotional thriller rather than a psychological thriller.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, I think many people, I think, would read this and feel that it is a thriller. You know, it is. I've been lucky to hear from readers that it feels thrilling to read in a sense that you want to turn the page. But I think the suspense, you know, really comes from the emotional suspense, you know, the relationships and how people are feeling towards each other, you know, alongside sort of the question of what has happened.
And you do that brilliant thing that a good author does, or a great author does, is you find yourself jumping emotionally with your investments from one character to another. So one moment you're going, oh, the poor guy, she sounds mad. And then you go, this poor woman, she has no sympathy. She's getting nothing from anybody. She's only a child. And then the next minute you go, God, the child is the omen. And, you know, I didn't know where to look.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the sort of story that I love to read, you know, and so it doesn't surprise me that it's sort of the story I ended up writing. But just that idea of really feeling so engaged as you read and feeling like you, along with the characters, are trying to figure out, you know, what reality is. You know, there are characters in this book and, you know, who each have a different, you know, version of reality or a different version of the truth. And, you know, we are reading this novel, you know, through a very intimate perspective of Blythe, you know, the mother in that book. And so we, you know, we see the world through her eyes, but we know there is more going on. And so as the reader, we're taken on this journey to sort of, we do, I think, flip-flop, and we do sort of, you know, feel empathy for you know, different characters at different points in the story. And I think, I think that's part of sort of the experience of this book, I hope, for readers.
There's also that taboo, isn't there, Ashley, of the conversation you're not really meant to have, which is, how are the kids? Great, but I'm not quite mad about the second one.
Yeah.
Who says that over a cup of coffee?
It's true. Yeah, I think, you know, there are so many taboos that still exist around motherhood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, I feel like, you know, in some ways, I think, you know, we've come, you know, far. I think of, you know, talking about, you know, postpartum, you know, mental health and depression. I think we've come far, thankfully, in those areas. But there are still so many things about motherhood that we don't feel we can speak honestly about, you know, certain questions we don't feel we can ask and answers we don't feel we can give. And yet I think for, you know, most women or most parents, I think in general, you know, the experience that we are expected to have, you know, going into it is very rarely what the experience is actually like.
Yeah.
And so this book explores, I think, some of those taboos that still exist.
You've said yourself, you say you love being a mother, of course, but with the caveat that you can love your children while still having days when you wish you didn't have the responsibility that come along with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, that feel that that was really my experience. You know, I don't regret having my children. I love them dearly. But I can, both of those things can be true, you know, that you can love them and that you can have days when you don't like motherhood, you know, when you don't like those responsibilities and those obligations and, you know, what it requires of you.
Yeah.
I think as a parent, you know, and that, and I think it's okay to admit that. And that's sort of what I've really been hearing, I think, from women, especially, you know, mothers who are reading the book and saying, you know, they really see themselves reflected in this experience that Blythe has, you know, on the pages of this book, you know, despite not having, you know, their lives don't look like hers, thankfully, in terms of the experience that she has and the outcome they have. But it's that, you know, it's that emotional space that that motherhood puts you in, you know, that can be very hard to come to terms with sometimes, I think.
I think some people actually might read the book and who some people in life have decided, I don't want children. I never wanted them.
Yeah.
I will never have them. And despite all the societal expectations and indeed pressures put on me, it's just not on, on my agenda. They might read certainly the push and think, they escaped a bullet there, right?
I have heard from women, you know, who have said that. And, you know, I've heard from women who have read it, who have said this has validated a lot of the reasons why they have not, you know, wanted to have children, which is, you know, fair enough. Yeah. But I think, you know, motherhood's not a choice for everybody. I mean, it's I guess it's not a choice for everybody. And it's also just not the decision that everybody wants to make. And I think, you know, sometimes in society, we can be kind of uncomfortable with that choice. We want to attach a reason to that. You know, why don't you want to be a mother? And we're almost you know, not happy until we know why that woman has not chosen, you know, motherhood. And I think this book makes a space for that. You know, there are women in this book who knew, you know, who felt like motherhood was not going to be for them and they were not meant to be a mother and they had to go through with it, you know, for various reasons. And so I think there is something a bit validating about that in this novel.
You do something really well in this book too, which is you follow the maternal gene through three generations. But you do it in a way that in other hands might have been labored, excuse the expression, but certainly would have just taken too much time or what have you. But you don't go over the top with it. You simply say there was trouble back in the generation before, the trouble back another generation before then again. And you pose the question without actually stating the obvious. Is it possible that that cruelty, unkindness or lack of maternal desire is hereditary?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I had sat down to write this book, that wasn't my intention, really. My intention was not to sort of go back and make this, you know, multi-generational. But I think as I was writing the main character, Blythe, I started to realize that I couldn't really, you know, completely understand her, you know, as a woman and certainly as a mother, if I didn't understand the mother that she came from. And so then, you know, the character of her mother was sort of born. And then as I was writing her mother, whose name is Cecilia, I had that same feeling about her. You know, I really needed to understand who she came from. And so that is sort of how these backstories of the mother and the grandmother came to be. But you know, I wanted them to feel exactly as you've described them. So thank you. But just that they are, you know, they are not central to this book, but it is important that the reader understands, you know, what had happened and what Blythe knows, you know, the anxiety that she carries, you know, of what she knows of these women's experience. And, you know, she really asks herself, you know, that question, exactly what you've just said, you know, do I have it in me? You know, what she didn't learn that, you know, she hasn't learned how to mother firsthand in a way that she is, would be proud of. You know, she had a very difficult experience in her childhood with her mother. But is it the case that it is really just not in her? you know, she is not capable. And I think that that's, you know, I think a lot of women, you know, when you're having your first child, maybe fathers too, but, you know, you sort of, you obviously, you know, reflect back on the way that you've been brought up, you know, and the parents you come from. And I think that's a huge part of, you know, how you, whether you are, you know, excited or fearful or any of the feelings that you have, you know, going into parenthood yourself. I think you can't help but think about that, you know, where you came from and the people you came from.
You also describe childbirth again without going over 400 pages about it. You simply, it's prosaic but profound, if I could make it, describe it like that. And you've said before that there's a huge connection between fear and motherhood, whether that's childbirth or the actual continuation of being a mother. But certainly as a man, as a father reading it, you kind of think, you know, I think a lot of things might have been underestimated at the time.
Yeah. You know, when I sat down to write that birth scene, you know, I sort of thought, you know, I had given birth at that point, I think when I wrote it once, and then I was, had another, my second child while I was revising this novel. So I had another chance at it as well.
But, yes.
You know, but I, you don't read a lot, you know, about that. You don't often read in a novel about, you know, a birth scene. And to your point, you know, in detail, not that it is a long birth scene, but it's just the real, you know, the real raw, you know, feelings, both physically and emotionally, I think that entails. And I felt it was important to capture in this book and sort of make a space for that, you know, for that that experience that Blythe has.
I'd love to know, Ashley, what men think of your book. I mean, I read it, and I'm saying to your face, as in a manner of speaking, because I loved it. If I didn't like it, I'd be very quiet about it. But I really did. It gave me insight, and as well as an enjoyable, as you say, thriller, an emotional thriller. Is there a common strain of thought between the male readers?
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that, because I was also quite fascinated to see how men would perceive the book, and it really means a lot to me to hear you say that. Thank you. But to hear from men, because the common sort of theme that I've heard from men who've read it is that it has really been eye-opening. You know, it has really changed their mind about what the experience of motherhood can be like. And what some of those emotions and feelings are. And, you know, in particular, I have had some men reach out to me who have had, you know, partners who have just had babies, you know, they have newborns at home, or partners who are pregnant. And they have said to me that they will now make space, you know, for a different kind of conversation with their partner. You know, they would ask a different question than they might have before. And I think that that's very meaningful to hear, of course, as a writer, but important. I think that's very important.
The child who grows up before our eyes with the turning of every page, Violet, who's just the letter N short of another meaningful word. I'm not sure if that's accident or design. Anyway, Violet is there, and she has what I describe as an evil eye. I mean, when she came on the page, like in a movie, like a baddie, you kind of go, oh no, oh yes. I was delighted and horrified at the same time. Like Hannibal Lecter, you're kind of going, he's the worst thing. I'm so frightened, and yet I'm delighted he's back. She had that malevolent presence.
She does. Yeah. And I think, you know, I wasn't totally sure exactly where I was going with Violet when I first sat down to write her. And I have to admit, she did get sort of worse and worse.
She's terrifying.
She's terrifying. Yeah. So I sort of just went for it, you know, and I've had people say to me, you know, what is her character based on? You know, this idea of a little girl who has this in her. And I can say it certainly wasn't me, my childhood, and it's certainly not my children. So I think I'm safe, I hope. But
the funny thing, Ashley, is that the great thing about Violet's character is that whatever about the occasional physical act, which we won't discuss because we don't want to give a thing away, but oftentimes it was her greatest weapon was her silence. And the greatest weapon a child can often have is the incredible sulk, where we can't get through that exterior shell, and that's punishing.
It is. It's so true. That's such a good observation of, you know, the way children can be. It is that silence. And it's also that ability to feel, I mean, and Violet certainly demonstrates this, but I mean, I think we all have this, you know, natural want to see the innocence in our children. You know, we want to default to, oh, they couldn't have, or they aren't thinking that, or they aren't this way, because it is so uncomfortable, you know, to think otherwise.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always want to give children sort of this benefit of the doubt. But the reality is that, you know, they are capable of more than we would like to believe. And I think that, and Violet is that, you know, she is the example of that, as uncomfortable as it is. Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good book. I mean, I just gobbled it all up. Yeah, congratulations. And I know you have a second one coming. I know that you've done major deals in Britain, Canada, the US. This is just one of those books that has taken off 32 markets around the world. It's going to be a movie. It's going to be, I kind of want to be there for when your kids are 16, 17 and reading it. And going, I want to film that. Going, Mom, who are you?
Well, I know. I have thought of that. I've thought of the very difficult conversations ahead and possibly therapy as well. We'll have to see.
Actually, you should start saving for vouchers, yeah. Christmas presents, vouchers for therapy for when you.
Author Ashley O'Drain on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Throughout the week, Liveline has been hearing from survivors of abuse at the hands of Jesuit priest Joseph Marmion, at large and abusing with impunity for decades. And the conversation continued today. Some of the testimony makes for very difficult listening, so please take care.
Back to this case of Joe Marmion, a Jesuit priest. He was a Jesuit priest until he died, by the way, even though 23 years previously, in 1977, the Jesuits said they knew he was a criminal and a paedophile, but they moved him from different settings, ministering settings, by the way, including a hospital. In the meantime, and he was buried, the death notice said quite clearly, deeply regretted by his the Jesuit community. And he was buried in the Jesuit plot where he now lies at near the front gate there, to the, as you go in the front gate of Glasnevin, it's up onto the far left with the other religious orders that are all near the front of the cemetery. And more people are contacting us about this man and the fact that he was on the rampage for decades, and nobody seemed, until now in 2021, when, and you heard from him on Friday, when one victim insisted that the Jesuits name him publicly, which they did last Tuesday week, and that's when they revealed they knew about him since 1977. And the situation, the Jesuits, unfortunately, we've been unable to get any reaction to our questions we've asked over the last few days about the when and the Gardaí and various other things. The Jesuits have taken it, they've become the poor clerics, they've taken a vow of silence, I think, but that's too flippant a remark for such a serious, serious topic, as you're about to hear in some of the letters I'm going to read out and some of the people we're going to talk to. I'll begin with Andrew, who's in North America, while we still have the line. Andrew, I know it's good morning to you. Good afternoon from Ireland. Can you tell us of your experience? I'll try not to ask too many questions because of the delay. But can you tell us, Andrew, of your experiences with Father Joseph Marmion?
Yeah. He was just a creep. He was always a creep to me, more than that. So I did end up in his singing class in first year. And he had us singing these. Elocution was like a big part of his thing, as far as I was concerned, and I felt that he was trying to kind of drum the Dublin accent out of me. But anyway, I did end up in his operetta, and as other callers have described, I went through that hideous costume fitting exercise, and let's just say he had me try on tights, and you know, I was 13 or something at the time, and he was just looking at me all lasciviously. He had this just creepy air about him all the time, like in his class, in his German class, you know, you put your hand up to go to the bathroom, and he'd, it's just his voice, it was sickening. He'd say, I hope it comes out all right, you know, in that sort of slimy tone.
Andrew, had you any idea what was, because we've heard this MO, his modus operandi was he was big into music, running the musicals in Belvedere and Crescent and Clongowes, I think he was involved as well, that he would bring, we've heard of assaults, or him deriving some form of sexual gratification from bringing boys up to that costume room and getting them to undress completely.
Yeah. Well, my own personal experience was that I was just so mortified with the whole thing. I never spoke to anyone about it. In fact, this is the first time I've ever spoken openly about it. You know, I've told one or two people since the story has arisen. I've told a couple of people, personal friends, but that was the thing that was, looking back on it now, that is so infuriating, because it was well known among the boys, you know, this guy was a creep, and there were, you know, I wasn't mature enough at the time to know exactly the extent, not mature enough, but we knew this guy was up to horrendous things, especially on these trips to Vienna. And we knew, you know, I didn't hang out with the kids who went on those trips. They usually his top singers. They were the ones that we just kind of knew, you know, without knowing the details, that they'd been subject to horrific things. Things that we didn't even understand at that time, or at least I didn't anyway. But, I mean, I can still picture one of those kids now, and my heart just goes out to what he had to go through in his life with that. You know, and this thing about Marmion being buried in a Jesuit plot and the fact that he was never defrocked and handed over to the police, it's the enablers. I'd say equally disgusted, but there was enabling going on there. There was a culture that just allowed people like that to operate. And you know that, Joe. You've had phone-ins on all kinds of folks like this. And it was in the culture. We were supposed to defer to these people, and they're supposed to be smarter than us. You know, he never impressed me with his smartness and his singing ability and all that. I hated the whole thing. I hated the operettas. I couldn't stand it. Dressing up in girls' clothes. I mean, as I said in the email to you, even that alone should have been a flag. I mean, that's just ridiculous. In an all-boys school to have forcing little boys to get into girls' costumes. I mean, mother of divine. Excuse my language. But just, I mean, you can hear it me now. I mean, This makes me emotional, you know. This is nearly 50 years ago, and it's not about what happened to me. It just makes me emotional that culture existed, and as I said to an email, I mean, just the contradictions rife in that institution, you know, that this was going on, and at the same time, you'd have, you know, there were good priests there, you know, who taught us great things about social justice and everything, but to live in that contradiction was just, it's just a bizarre culture that they, and like I said, they were neighbours, they were priests. There was one of the stories I listened to, one of your callers, and I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he talked about a priest poking his head in the door while all this was going on.
They just knew,
you know, and we know that they knew, but, you know, and I don't know what justice looks like at this stage, I really don't.
That was Andrew, and later Joe heard from John, who was a student in Clongowes when Marmion was prefect.
He was a vile person who preyed upon people. He ran a very strict regime for punishment. I mean, I suffered under his hands for punishment beatings, where he would bring you up to his office and tell you to take your trousers down or your pants, and he would beat you on your bare backside. He was a vile person who would be hard words to describe, but he victimized people basically anyway. And
then not just the beatings, with this implement he called the pandy bat.
Yes. I told you, researcher. You know, people would ask, what's the pandy bat? The last time I saw a pandy bat was in the James Joyce Tower out in Sandy Cove. It was actually on the wall. And I said to the man in charge there, I said, do you know what that is on the wall? And he said, no. He said, I'm intrigued. He said, it's been on the wall. I said, well, James Joyce went to Clongowes, as I did.
And he went to Belvedere. He was a Jesuit boy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was indeed. And I said, that was used for punishment beatings. I said, it was manufactured in such a way that for the Jesuits that there was actually lead in the two ends of it, and there was spring steel in it, which it made quite an impression on your either your hands or on your backside as well.
And Morris there alluded to a number of things, but including his humiliation of young boys.
He did. I mean, I told your researcher before I came on that before I did my inter certificate, he said to me and two other guys, one of them is deceased, still one of them alive. He said to the three of us, because he nicknamed us the Three Musketeers, he said, "You three guys might as well go home now with the rest of the pupils and don't bother sitting your inter cert because you haven't a chance of getting it. You're useless."
Good God.
So basically, I sat my inter, I got
which
it.
Which was the junior cert in those days.
Junior cert, yeah, before your final years.
Yeah.
And I got it, I got two honours in it. And when I came back in for fifth year for picking out our subjects, each student went in to Marmion and would adjudicate what subjects would be suitable for them. So when I came into his office, he said, "Oh, here's Sheridan," he said, "the man that didn't deserve to get the inter cert." I said, "Well, Father, I did get it." And I said, "I don't know whether you're aware of it, but I might as well tell you that during the Christmas holidays, I cycled from my home up to Walkinstown to do mass grinds." "Oh, so what?" he said. I said, "No, I said, I'm not boasting about the fact, but I said, you know, you kind of dismiss people because, and you're dismissive of me because I got the exam." And this was typical of, you know, he dismissed people, made little of people.
Humiliated people. And you know, other priests, as Andrew said, who enabled other priests. But John, this bizarre story of your partner in St. Vincent's Hospital in 1998, which is now 11 years after the Jesuits discovered he was a criminal and a paedophile, but they now had him as a chaplain in St. Vincent's Private Hospital, and your partner came across him. Tell us about that episode, John, briefly,
well,
please.
Basically, my partner went in for cancer treatment, and she was terminally ill, and she went to get confessions, and I wasn't aware of the fact that Marmion was chaplain at the time, but anyway, she got her confession heard, and the priest said to her that he wouldn't grant her absolution because she was living with somebody, and he would only grant her absolution on the condition that she said that she would give an undertaking that she wouldn't live with this person when she got back out of hospital. I don't know whether he was aware that she was terminally ill, but she wasn't aware of it at the time, but I was anyway.
Good God.
And this was the stipulation. There was no absolution unless she gave a commitment. It was only afterwards that I discovered that it was Marmion, and Marmion was chaplain.
And apparently the nuns in St. Vincent's held him in high regard, John. Anyway.
Well, this is it. The people on your programme said she went to his mass and found him a very jovial, amicable kind of person. any of the guys that went to Clongowes, they're... I haven't heard anybody speak up about the man, and nobody on your programme has come up.
That's true.
He was an evil, vile man, and was let get away with it. Both when you think of what happened in three different schools, it wasn't just in one school. He was in Limerick.
In four different decades, from the 1960s.
Exactly.
And remember, you can find support and helpline information online at rte.ie/support. The disappearance of an Irishman in Australia's Northern Territory over 3 years ago has both police and amateur sleuths scratching their heads. It's a story that's garnered huge interest in Australia. An isolated outback town, long-running feuds, sinkholes, crocodiles. But where is Paddy Moriarty? Police are now offering a $250,000 reward for any information pertaining to the Abbeyfeel native's disappearance. And on Morning Ireland, we heard from Kylie Stevenson, co-host of the popular Lost in Larrima podcast. First, we hear Kylie chatting to Larrima local, Cookie.
There's not much going on around here.
Cookie lives in this speck of a town called Larrima in outback Australia. Only 12 people live here and most of them are in their 70s. But it's not quite true that there's nothing going on here. We've only been in Cookie's house 2 minutes. We're literally still setting up the recorder when...
There's not much going on around here. What have you got? Oh, Paddy went missing.
And Kylie joins us now. Good morning, Kylie. Thanks for taking our call today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Set the scene for us first. Tell us a little bit more about Larimer.
Larimer is about 500 kilometres south of Darwin, which is the capital of the Northern Territory. It's a very small town. It's only, usually the population hovers around 10. When Paddy was living there, it was about 12. There's just a pub and a handful of people. Most of them are sort of retirees who've moved there for the peace and quiet. And there's not a lot going on there these days.
And what do you know of what happened to Paddy Moriarty?
So Paddy was last seen at the Larimer Hotel on the 16th of December 2017. He spent most of, you know, most days he would go over to the pub and have a drink and have a yarn with his friends who were around. And he did that on the 16th of December. And then he jumped on his quad bike with his dog Kelly, drove over the road to his house, and he was never seen again.
You met him, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I was in Larimer about a year before he went missing. I spent 2 weeks there on a riding retreat. And I'd sort of venture out of my room most afternoons and have a drink in the bar. And Paddy was always there. So, yeah, I'd often have a bit of a chat with him.
Now, he was from here originally. Tell us a little bit more about what you learned about him and how he ended up in Australia and in that particular part of Australia.
Yeah, so what we know is that he was born in Abbeyfeel in Ireland, and he came over to Australia in 1967 when he was about 19 years old. From an interview we've actually only been recently given by a friend of his, had recorded him a few years ago talking about his past, we learned that he came straight to Darwin on a boat. Was picked up by the people that he was working for on a cattle station in the Northern Territory. That job was arranged before he left Ireland. And he spent about, I think, more than a decade, probably, closer to 2 or 3 decades working down on that particular cattle station. And then, you know, the rest of his life was spent working around the Northern Territory doing various things.
Why do police believe he was murdered, Kylie?
I think the big indicator was that his dog was also missing. So there was an extensive search for Paddy when his disappearance was reported to police. There was no sign of him. He was definitely a creature of habit. He did the same kind of things every day, you know, walked his dog in a particular area of the town, went to the pub. So all of those areas were searched where he could possibly have walked. And you know, obviously, initially they sort of suspected it could be a medical episode or something like that, because he was 70 actually when he went missing. But after they searched the area extensively and couldn't find any indication of him, they realised that something else must have been going on. And once they started investigating, they did find out that the town of Larimer has a lot of rifts in it. There's a lot of people who don't like one another, and you know, Paddy was caught up in some of those problems there.
Why do you think his story and his disappearance have attracted such attention?
I think it's just one of those outback mysteries where people like to have an opinion on what they think happened. And I think also all of the possibilities are just absurd. You know, they're talking, you know, when police were looking, they were talking about sinkholes. It's an area where there are sinkholes and caves, whether he could have fallen into one or whether his body has been hidden in one. There are death adders in that area. There are occasionally crocodiles. That's not entirely true. There's a pet crocodile at the pub, but there are occasionally, in flood times, there are crocodiles around as well. So I guess because there are so many unusual possibilities, it's really kind of gripped a lot of people around the world.
Co-host of the Lost in Larimer podcast, Kylie Stevenson on Morning Ireland. Critics of so-called cancel culture abound, but it's rare for one to essentially cancel himself. I'm referring, of course, to Piers Morgan's dramatic exit live on air from Good Morning Britain, seemingly in response to comments from his colleague Alex Beresford. Today with Claire Byrne shared a clip of the big moment.
I think that we need to all take a step back. And I understand that you don't like Meghan Markle. You've made it so clear a number of times on this programme, a number of times. And I understand that you've got a personal relationship with Meghan Markle, or had one, and she cut you off. She's entitled to cut you off if she wants to. Has she said anything about you since she cut you off? I don't think she has, but yet you continue to trash her.
OK, I'm done with this.
No, no, no.
Sorry, no. Sorry.
Do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, maybe not my
own. No.
See you later.
I'm being...
Sorry, can't do this.
This is absolutely diabolical behaviour. I'm sorry, but Pierce spouts off on a regular basis and we all have to sit there and listen. 6:30 to 7 o'clock yesterday was incredibly hard to watch.
News then came out that Morgan and Good Morning Britain would be parting company. And this morning, co-host Susanna Reid had to address the elephant not in the room.
There are many voices on GMB and everyone has their say. But now Piers has decided to leave the programme. Some of you may cheer and others will boo. He has been my presenting partner, Monday to Wednesday, for more than 5 years. And during Brexit and the pandemic and other issues, he has been a voice for many of you and a voice that many of you have railed against. It is certainly going to be very different. But shows go on, and so on we go.
Joining Claire Byrne this morning were Duncan Larricombe, former royal editor of The Sun and author of Prince Harry, The Inside Story, and Sam Bright, chief politics and investigations reporter at the Byline Times. Duncan was in the interesting position of appearing on Good Morning Britain today. So what was the vibe?
Yes, it was rather difficult, actually, to be a contributor to a show that was on the front pages of all the papers as I spoke. Yeah, quite difficult. But I sensed, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I sensed that there was real shock and chaos behind the scenes of what is sort of the premier number one breakfast TV show. So yeah, quite an experience this morning.
Yeah, because I think like he did storm off yesterday, but then he came back, and I think people were saying, yes, "Oh, look, it's just a Piers thing. It's what he does." And then that bombshell announcement last night that he was gone.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there have been murmurings in the past that he was on the brink of quitting the show anyway, you know, months and months ago. But irrespective of that, look, love Piers Morgan or loathe him, the reality is, he turned Good Morning Britain into, at times, unmissable television. And, you know, it's very sad that he probably did overstep the mark to the point where he decided that was it. He was off.
Sam, you don't think it's sad at all, do you?
Well, I just find it quite bizarre that it's turned into the Piers Morgan roadshow, this whole thing. I mean, the way that Susanna Reid was talking about him this morning sort of treated him like a spiritual leader of breakfast television. You know, Piers Morgan is important, but we need to put this into perspective. We're talking about allegations of potential racism and a lack of emotional support from the royal family, and that, I think, should probably be the story rather than Piers Morgan cancelling himself on his own programme.
What did you think of the monologue from Alex Beresford? I think it was quite courageous when I was watching it back. I thought, well, you know, there's probably not many people who would do that in the presence of Piers Morgan.
No, I thought it was bold. I thought it was very bold, and I thought he judged himself well. I think that Piers clearly took offence to the personal relationship between himself and Meghan being discussed, and lots of people have cited that as a reason why Piers seems to have this vendetta against Meghan, and I'm sure there will be more to come out in future about that, because it clearly hit a raw nerve and Piers felt as though he had to take a breather.
Duncan, what did you think about it? Like, was it just a divergence of views, or was it an on-air attack?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I having been a reasonably frequent contributor to Good Morning Britain, when they're absolutely desperate for a royal commentator and can't find anyone else, I go on there. But what I can tell your listeners is that it's not scripted, but the producers are always at Good Morning Britain at pains to kind of work out what it is you're going to say if you're going to contribute to the show. And look, I mean, Alex, straight on air, blindsided his colleague. And I don't think there's any suggestion that Piers saw it coming, was expecting it, or that it was rehearsed. It was just natural emotion, which, to be honest, is Piers's trademark, that emotion, and he had it turned on himself.
Yeah, but what Piers had said previously, the day before, surely you agree that was unacceptable, to say that he didn't believe what Meghan Markle said about her own feelings of being suicidal.
Yes, look, I just wanted to pick up on that, but also what Sam said, which I enjoyed. You know, yeah, he's not many people out there that don't like Piers are losing an awful lot of sleep, and many of them might be asking, why is Piers Morgan the story? But the reason for that is he positioned himself, ever since Meghan arrived on the scene, as her number one critic. And I can tell you now that Harry and Meghan, although they've had a pretty horrendous couple of days, they will have popped champagne with delight last night that the king is dead, Piers has gone.
Because you've sat in that studio while he was going off on one about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry.
I have, yeah.
And what is that like? I mean, do you think it's real? Is this genuinely how he feels about them?
Yes, oh, very much so. You know, look, it is showmanship, it is over the top, it's Piers's style, and it's made him an international star. Don't forget, he had a massive broadcasting role in America before he came back to Good Morning Britain. Mm-hmm. So he's known over the other side of the pond as well. But yeah, I mean, his style is quite hard to sit and be on his panel being asked questions. But I'm lucky. My background is tabloid journalism, so is his. But every time I've gone on Good Morning Britain, I've thought, my goodness, thank goodness that I'm not actually at loggerheads with him, because I wouldn't have been as brave as Alex was to challenge him. It's quite a terrifying prospect, I can assure you of that.
I always thought his story about Meghan Markle was a bit odd. You know, Sam, how he said he was in contact with her on Twitter, they were getting on quite well, and then he felt that she dumped him. I just thought it was a strange thing for a man who, you know, has a wife, children, to be saying. It sounded like he had an expectation of, you know, this relationship developing, what kind of a relationship, I don't know, and then it didn't happen, so he turned on her.
Yeah. Well, look. Oh, sorry Sam. Sorry. No, you go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that this is kind of Piers Morgan's style as well, as Duncan was saying, is that he turns political issues into personal ones because he knows that people will engage with that a lot more. Like Duncan says, he is a tabloid master and he's a master of the genre. And he's done that with coronavirus as well. I mean, he's turned him holding the government into account into a running sort of pitch battle between himself and Matt Hancock and various ministers, which makes it so engaging for people to tune into every day. And I feel as though he wants to do that with Meghan, but she just hasn't bitten back, at least in a public forum so far.
Where do you think he'll show up next, Sam?
I think, well, it's clear that he's being courted by GB News and News UK TV, both of which are ostensibly anti-woke platforms that are due to set up in the next few months. I think there'll probably be a bidding war for his services. It sounds like GB News might be ahead where that is concerned. But he clearly wants to retain his role as a real shaper of political debate and to be given a lot of freedom to say what he wants, which he hasn't been in the past couple of days because ITV have ditched him.
Duncan, maybe it's been it was part of a grand plan. He was going anyway.
Well, it could be. Sam speaking there made me something occurred to me that, you know, ultimately Piers might well be the winner out of this, and he might double, triple, quadruple his salary. Which sort of adds a kind of extraordinary element to what happened yesterday morning. But, you know, I think the real problem, why this went wrong, is that up until the Oprah Winfrey show was aired, Piers would tell us every morning how we should think about Meghan, what our opinion should be. The problem was that 2 hours of television for the first time gave your listeners a chance to make their own minds up, not be told what we should think, because they're there, we can judge it for ourselves. And, you know, that's why it was such a compelling interview with Oprah, I think.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary. I mean, you can understand there being huge interest in it where you are, but 54% of the Irish television audience watched that programme, that interview here on Monday night. Just a huge level of interest. And it's just fascinating to see what the public attitude has been in the aftermath of it. I mean, Duncan, coming from your perspective as a former royal correspondent, where do you feel the attitude is there now as the dust begins to settle to Harry and Meghan?
Well, do you know what? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think anyone does, and I'll tell you why. Stories normally always are about a hero, a victim, or a villain. You know, if you think beyond that, that is the explanation for most stories. In this instance, it's fascinating because who's the hero? Is it the Queen? Is it Meghan? Who's the victim? Is it Meghan or is it the royal family? Who's the villain? Is it Harry or this alleged racist member of the royal family whose identity we still don't know? It's absolutely fascinating.
It certainly is, and it probably doesn't end here.
And how right she was. During the course of the show, more details came to light about what had been going on behind the scenes.
Piers Morgan's decision, or I don't know whose decision it was, whether it was ITV's or himself, but to leave Good Morning Britain because of what he said about Meghan Markle. Now, the PA agency is reporting that Meghan Markle complained about what he said. They understand that Duchess's concern was not about the personal attacks on the validity of her racism allegation made against the royal family or her claims that she was not supported by the institution when experiencing suicidal thoughts. But what she made clear in her complaint, that she was concerned about how Piers Morgan's comments may affect the issue of mental health generally and those attempting to deal with their own problems. ITV bosses, this report goes on to say, had asked Piers Morgan to apologise to the Duchess during the show on Tuesday, that's yesterday, but he refused. So there you go, you can see how that developed into him walking out and leaving.
Duncan Larracombe and Sam Bright chatting with Claire Byrne. A new survey from Red Sea for Mental Health Ireland explores the extent to which parents have felt that the pressures of homeschooling during lockdown have been seriously damaging to their mental and physical health. And on Drive Time, Sarah and Cormac heard from Mental Health Ireland board member, child and adolescent psychotherapist Dr. Coleman Nochter.
Yeah, I think from the point of view when we went to look at this, there was a... We just were getting a lot of calls about people who were finding the whole working from home and homeschooling incredibly stressful. But when the poll showed that almost 80% were describing an increase in stress levels, that was kind of where we would have thought. But what we also saw was there was a lot of people in self-doubt, thinking they weren't doing enough, maybe comparing themselves to other people, feeling that other people were getting a lot more done than they were doing. But there was a very high percentage of over 60% who would have had children between the ages of 4 and 12 who were doing roughly 4 hours a day of homeschooling. And I suppose when you factor in the fact of maybe having to do your own Zoom meetings or whatever the case may be on top of that, you know, you have to find that 4 hours a day. I think there was a sense of people feeling that there were maybe lousy employees and lousy parents and really kind of getting on top of it all. And again, we did see an increase in people who were, their alcohol consumption was going up, their exercise levels were going down. So lots of the things that we would be encouraging to manage mental fitness were being sacrificed because, and we can only imagine that due to the increased stress levels, those are things that tends to happen. But we also found that a high percentage of children were having no social contact outside of their family and bubble, which is understandable. But I think the sense of isolation, the sense of the bubble, the sense of the stress at home were all kind of amounting to quite a stressful recipe, if you can imagine most households.
And in terms then of the self-doubt and the effect on parents' confidence levels, I'll just give you one or two of the texts that we've had in on this. One person says, homeschooling was really hard. I'm a frontline worker trying to work and homeschool. Breaks were doing English, Irish and maths. Roll on next Monday, says this person, when I can completely concentrate on work. Another person says, it's been extremely stressful in our house, both parents essential workers, 3 children under 6. The feeling of guilt, never getting time to facilitate homeschooling has been horrendous. It's a shame that the children of frontline workers were never facilitated, says that person. This idea of comparing ourselves as parents to other parents and wondering, you know, am I doing enough? And I'm sure I'm probably not doing enough. And maybe I could be doing more in Irish or more in English or whatever it might be. That was a big feature.
Yeah, I think from the point of view of most of us who were doing it, we kind of got to a level here in my house where if it wasn't coming up on the leaving cert, we weren't doing it. There's kind of like a lot of the, you know, get a plate and cover it with flour. You're kind of going, no, that's not happening. You know, we don't have time for that. But from the point of view of you, I suppose when you look at kind of the Facebook groups or the WhatsApps where people are making bird feeders and taking pictures of hedgehogs and doing nature walks, you just feel utterly lousy that you haven't had the time to invest in that. And, you know, you want to do your best. Nobody wants to fail their child or not do their best with it. But when you have the demands of maybe three children, which I had here around the one table, you know, all different parts of the curriculum, you had to kind of cut your cloth and say, this is actually not possible. I have to manage my expectations of myself here. What I'm being asked to do is impossible. So, you know, there probably are days where my work has to take precedent and the school homeschooling has to take a hit. And other days when I have more time, I'll be able to invest in it. But nobody likes to underperform. And we always focus on the human deficit.
Can I ask you about that, Colm, if you don't mind? Firstly, can I say thank you? Because when we were homeschooling, and it is a pressurised situation for everyone, I saw a post on social media from yourself, and you said one of your lads wasn't feeling like doing some maths or whatever it was that day, so you both went for a walk. And I said to myself, well, if Coleman Nochtra can take a break like that, so can I. So thank you for that. The worrying thing here, though, is that the survey shows that this kind of pressure and stress is putting a strain between parents and their children. I mean, how do you rectify that?
I think for the very reason what you just said, I mean, we have to prioritise emotional well-being in the home, and especially at the moment. Children are cocooned in a bubble. Their home has to feel homely. And when your kitchen becomes your classroom, there's going to be an intrusion on that. And I was all in favour of pulling the plug on it. As it starts to get too stressed, forget the mats and just go for the walk. And, you know, I would prioritise your children's happiness and your family's atmosphere way over getting sums finished or whatever the case may be. I believe that our children will catch up academically on this stuff, but the social and emotional stuff is where the priority is. And for me, that may be a slower recovery. Yeah. And it was really about putting that first and not feeling guilty about it. And the
other side of it, you mentioned it there, is isolation. Isolation is really worrying because in school, children have other children to bounce ideas off or to have a bit of a laugh or play football or whatever the case may be. When they're at home, it's far more difficult, isn't it?
It's really interesting. We're kind of gathering a few children's voices at the moment for another project. And it was interesting that they were kind of saying, there's nothing to shoot the breeze about. I don't have any news. So I'm avoiding social contact. You know, so we used to FaceTime all the time, but now that it's actually the social task is becoming much more a challenge and a chore than something to be enjoyed, which is, you know, for children, like if you don't have the currency of events and things to chat about, it's a worry that they would kind of avoid social situations. And I think we can get comfortable in social avoidance. And that would be the worry for me. And what we've seen is lots of children who have returned last week or maybe returning, feeling anxious about the return or reboarding into the social melee because they've gotten used to the cocooning nature of isolation.
It's not all bad, though, from this study, is it, Coleman? Because there is a finding there that 6 in 10 described how they felt more connected to their children as a result of their time spent homeschooling. And we have a couple of texts in on that as well, sort of, that seems to back that up. One person says, I loved homeschool. Great, clear work on Seesaw from the teachers. Great to know what stage my junior infant and senior infant are at so I can reinforce their learning at home. My daughter loves sending reply videos to her teacher with her homework. It really helped her confidence in her presentation skills, and my son's Irish has definitely improved with homeschooling, says this person. So that person had a very positive experience of it.
Yeah, and I think with all experiences, you're going to have people who will maybe see that. I mean, we do have a lot of quality time with our children than we never had before. And I really think in terms of COVID, there was a necessary pause that we needed to put on life. But I think for me, the pause has gone on too long now. And I think we're ready to go back. But I suppose the old mental well-being thing is everything in moderation. And maybe it's just not very moderate in terms of when you're stuck at home for 3 months. But yeah, of course, there will be people who maybe have the time or energy to be able to engage in the homeschooling process, and more power to them. But I think from the point of view of our the suggestion of 80% of people feeling more stressed would probably be more representative of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and to be fair, the texts that we're getting in honestly are more representative of that stress as well, and some people really have been put under huge stress in relation to this. One person here saying, as a parent of three boys, all homeschooling, I feel so inadequate. I'm questioning my parenting skills or lack of, to the point that I just cry daily. My mental health is very affected. I have a knot in my stomach constantly. My work is actually a welcome distraction, says that person. I mean, that is so difficult for that person. I wonder what advice would you have for them, Coleman? Because it's very human as a parent to be worrying about your kids, especially if you've got older kids who've been out of school for this long now, cumulatively over the last year, you know, and you might, like, it is your responsibility that when they go back that they don't fall behind, or at least that's certainly the narrative that I would have had, and I think a lot of parents would have had in their heads. And it's very difficult to counter that narrative that if you don't do your job, when they go back, they'll be behind all the other kids and that'll be your fault and your failing. So how do you counter that or help yourself with that?
I think, first of all, you have to see this as survival mode. This is a pandemic. And from the point of view of your normal expectations have to be managed. And, you know, the way Coleman Nocter or Sarah McNerney's kid goes back and the teacher goes, oh, my God, what have they been doing with this child? He's, you know, that's not a reflection of you. It's a reflection of an emergency pandemic. And my saying, and I'm repeating it to myself all the time over the last while, is maybe we're not failing at anything. Maybe we're surviving everything. And maybe it is just about getting through it and white-knuckling through it. And actually, that's enough.
I'll just give you one more text on this. Myself and my husband are both essential workers trying to juggle homeschooling. Four kids under 10, one with special educational needs, with work, negotiating, working from home where possible, worrying about the kids, stress levels, loneliness, lack of motivation, school piling on the work, teaching long division, fractions, phonics. It's all super stressful. We had three Zoom classes, very poor support from teachers in general. If schools close again, I just won't be able to do it, says that person. And I suppose, as you say, Coleman, it's really about looking towards surviving it and hoping the schools won't close again.
Yeah, and we're all hopeful that they won't. And I think the manner in which the return is seems much more carefully thought out and everything else. But from the point of view of expectation minus reality equals happiness. And reality has shifted, so we have to shift our expectations. And if you didn't get enough homeschooling today and your children are still safe and they're still loved, that's enough. If they have too much screen time today, still safe, still loved, it's fine. And just try and manage, and again, survival mode, we just have to get through it.
Still safe, still loved. My new mantra. Dr. Coleman Nocter on Drive Time.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today, but remember you can listen back to any of the featured programmes in full over on rte.ie/Radio 1, and most are available wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're one of the small handful of people who still haven't watched the Harry and Meghan Oprah interview, you can find that in full over on RTE Player. And a final reminder that if you've been affected by any of the issues brought up today, helpline information can be found at rte.ie/support. And that's it for this edition of Playback Daily with me, Gemma Craddock. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow.